You know, it's always difficult to come up with a topic for a sermon. And usually it's Terry, my wife, who says, well, have you thought about this or what about that? And probably 75% of the time, the topic is something that Terry's had gel in her mind. So you can thank her after the sermon today for the message. Because this is an idea that she had, and so I ran with it. And it's actually rather intriguing. And it fits even with this time of the year. In the United States and Canada, there's a national holiday that many of us observe, Thanksgiving. It's an appropriate festival for us to be involved in, and one that we look forward to. And in the scriptures, we see that some festivals are appropriate, even though they're not God's feasts or God's holy days. Some countries, because they've had a particular blessing, a deliverance, or a great victory in their nation, they've created a national holiday. And they're appropriate, and we see examples of them in the Bible. On the other hand, there are some festivals that are highly inappropriate for Christians to get involved in. And one of them will be coming up on October 31st, Halloween. And there's another one coming up on December 25th. And it's an attempted blend of paganism with professing Christianity, and it doesn't work. We do not get involved in those festivals. There's a holiday that occurs around this time of the year that God's people in ancient times did accept upon themselves to observe. And that is the Feast of Dedication, or Hanukkah, as it's called. And ironically, many people think of it as a kind of like a Jewish Christmas. But the very existence of the Feast of Dedication actually is in effect a rebuttal against Christmas. Now, Hanukkah is not for the church to observe as a commandment, but you hear about it. You browse the web, you see the news, you might even read about it in the Bible. But have you ever given it some thought? Jesus observed it with his nation when he walked the earth during his human ministry. And there's some fascinating historical background to this subject. Why? I've titled today's sermon, not Hanukkah or the Feast of Dedication, I've titled today's sermon, What is the Abomination of Desolation? And I believe as we move through the sermon today, you'll have a much greater depth of understanding about biblical prophecies that are yet to occur. And it's because of the Feast of Dedication. Jesus referred to historical events surrounding the Feast of Dedication in many of his own important prophecies. So I think you need to understand the background so you can see and be more spiritually aware yourself as we begin to approach the time when certain end-time prophecies are going to be fulfilled. So let's turn to the book of John, John chapter 10, and look at verses 22 and 23. John 10, verse 22, where we read, that was the Feast of Dedication in Jerusalem, and it was winter. The Feast of Dedication was in the wintertime. And Jesus walked in the temple in Solomon's porch. So Jesus was up there at the time when the whole celebration was going on. The Feast of Dedication, known today as Hanukkah, was once also called the Feast of the Maccabees. It's a Jewish festival. It's a festival observed for 8 days from the Hebrew month of Kislev, on the 25th of Kislev, for 8 days. And it usually falls in December. But due to the Hebrew calendar and differing months each year, sometimes it's even in November. And we are now approaching, of course, that time of the year. It was instituted in 165 BC by Judas Maccabeus, with his brothers and the elders of the Jewish people. And it was in commemoration of the reconsecration of the Jerusalem temple and its altar and the sacrifices. The temple had been desecrated earlier during persecution under Antiochus Epiphanes, that persecution began in 168 BC, 3 years earlier. What kind of understanding do you have here of John 10, verse 22? We've got a few weeks yet until this year's observance of that festival. Do you know why the Jews keep these days? Do you know why Jesus thought them appropriate to observe? Well, there's actually a very good reason why we too should be aware of what happened that led to the Jews observing the Feast of Dedication. We don't celebrate them. We're not Jews, and they're not commanded. But learning about them helps us understand Bible prophecy in a fascinating way. And you'll see that Hanukkah is in direct opposition, a rebuttal to those people who compromise and celebrate the winter solstice, those who celebrate the sun god, or in today's parlance, those who celebrate Christmas. This winter festival reminds the Jews from year to year how God had intervened, not only to save the nation physically, as at the time of Esther, you remember, but to save the nation spiritually. You've read the book of Esther, and that was, in effect, an attempted genocide of the Jewish people. Kill them all. But Hanukkah commemorates the victory over a spiritual genocide. The idea was to pressure the Jews, to force them to submit and forsake their religion. And if they would have forsaken their way of life, they would have remained alive. It wouldn't have been genocide. But they would have blended into the rest of the world. They would have disappeared as the Old Testament people of God. And all of this was prophesied in advance in their scriptures, in their scrolls that they pulled out each week at the temple. They may not have understood fully what they were doing with this Feast of Dedication, but they were actually fulfilling prophecy. And in retrospect, decades and centuries later, the Jews no doubt looked back and saw certain prophecies and realized that they had been a part of it. So let's go to the story in Daniel chapter 8. It's a prophecy of the time of Antiochus, when God's people of that day, you know, the church in the wilderness, as it's called in Acts chapter 7, verse 38, whose very existence was in jeopardy, especially their religion. In Daniel 8, there's a prophecy of what would be happening between the times of the Old and New Testaments. It's a prophecy of the intertestamental period and the various empires would rise and fall and how God's people would be affected by those empires. You know, the Bible contains a lot of history, but it's only history when it comes to affect the people of God. You know, you don't read about China or Japan in here, but as Israel was affected by the nations around them. Now, you remember that the northern kingdom of Israel had already gone into captivity and disappeared from history. The southern kingdom of Judah had also been exiled to Babylon for their sins. But a remnant had returned to the promised land under Ezra and Nehemiah, and now under the watchful eye of the Persian Empire. After the Persian Empire, the prophecies show that the next empire would be a Hellenistic empire based in Macedonia. A Greek empire would be next. And in chapter 8, we see a prophecy of Alexander the Great. He represented the Greek empire. And he's featured here as the goat who subdues the Medes and the Persians. You know, and brings the Greeks onto the scene. Look at Daniel 8, verse 8. Therefore, the male goat grew very great. And that, as you study history and go through the whole chapter, you realize was picturing Alexander. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken. You know, he died, actually, at an early age. And in place of it, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. So Alexander was replaced by four rulers. When Alexander's empire divided upon his death, it divided into four major parts. And look at verse 9 of Daniel 8. And out of one of them, so out of one of the four, came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, towards the east, and toward the glorious land. Here we see an empire that absorbed the heartland of God's people, which is where Jerusalem and the temple existed, right? The very center of Old Testament religion was now occupied by a foreign ruler. And this little horn was based in what is today Syria. And he is pictured in Scripture as the king of the north at that time. So we have an empire based in Syria, ruling over the land of Canaan or Palestine, the land of Israel, the promised land, or as it's called here, the glorious land. And these Syrians had now been Hellenized. They were part of the great empire of their day. We now have the rule of the Greek civilization over God's people. And now notice verse 10. And it grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. So at some stage in this development, the empire to the north began to take a very negative view of people who had cultural differences with them. And the attempt was made to force the Jewish population to blend, to make them assimilate with the rest of the empire. And, as I said, the Jews were trampled to the ground. They were being Hellenized religiously and culturally. And this was done by force. And it was also done with some collaborators from within who saw an advantage for themselves. But most of the pressure eventually came from a king known in history as Antiochus. Antiochus IV, who took the title of Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. And Epiphanes, in effect, means God manifest. He thought of himself as a kind of God incarnate. And evidently he saw himself as the ruler of this great civilization who should be worshipped as a god. And he didn't want any other gods to interfere with people being completely submissive to him. His enemies called him by a Greek expression that translates Antiochus the Mad. Rather than Antiochus God Manifest, his enemies called him Antiochus the Mad. Look at chapter 8 here, verse 11. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. Notice that's a capital P. He was equating himself with God. And by him, the daily sacrifices at the temple were taken away, and the place of God's sanctuary was cast down. Now, as you know, at that time, God's work consisted of certain physical activities that were intended to educate the people, certain rituals and sacrifices that were intended to point to Jesus Christ and the truth that we now know in the New Testament. Christ came to fulfill the meaning of those sacrifices. And Antiochus got rid of those by force, and he went beyond that. He tried to stamp out the Jewish religion and the truth of God. And eventually, not only did he stop the sacrifices, he set up his own. And he took unclean animals, very likely he took a pig, and put it right on the altar where God's sacrifices normally would be offered. And then he had a statue of Zeus, or one of his other Greek gods, placed in the temple. in the book, A History of the Jews, by historian Solomon Grazel, he has a section that talks about how Antiochus was celebrating his birthday at this time, which was also likely the birthday of the sun god. In other words, it was a sort of proto-Christmas festival that he was celebrating. He was celebrating a day in honor of himself and the sun god, and he set up a statue of one of the gods of his people and sacrificed a pig to it. And what does the Bible call it? The Bible calls it the abomination that makes desolate, or the abomination of desolation. And that's what Antiochus did. It's history. And those events were types of events that are yet to occur. Who will be the Antiochus of the future that does this? Now, we may not understand how those events will play out finally in the end time, but what we read here is typical of what is yet to come also, as we'll see. It's a dual prophecy. In verse 12, because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn, so it was done by force, to oppose the daily sacrifices of the Jews, and he cast the truth to the ground, God's truth, and he did all this and prospered. So this was a period of time when he was trying to stamp out the truth by force with an army. But God's people rallied. God intervened for them, and they finally were victorious. It took about 3 years of struggle from the time that the abomination first occurred to when the temple was again cleansed. Read verses 13 and 14 with me. But Daniel here in a vision, in a prophecy, he says, "Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking." So this is kind of a conversation going on in heaven, right? "How long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation?" How long is this going to go on? "The giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot." And he said to me, "For 2,300 days, then the sanctuary shall be cleansed." Days here should be translated as evenings and mornings. If you check out the Hebrew and you check out Bible commentaries, you find that what we're dealing with here is 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices. Every evening there was a sacrifice, and every morning there was a sacrifice. And you can read about this in Leviticus 6, verses 9 and 12. But in other words, 2,300 evening and morning sacrifices is actually 1,150 days. It's half as much. So 1,150 full days, and then the sanctuary will be cleansed, is what the holy ones were discussing here. It's a period of just over 3 years. This was a prophecy written by Daniel hundreds of years in advance. A prophecy of a very important period in the history of God's people, which, as you go through the history books, you'll find was fulfilled between 168 and 165 BC. Roughly December of 168 to December of 165. Now, here's where the story gets interesting. Those Jews in Jerusalem, those at the center of things in Jerusalem, tended to collaborate with Antiochus. But out in the suburbs, out in the rural areas, there was a family of priests who were very zealous for God's law. And this family of priests led the resistance against Antiochus. They were led by Judah Maccabeus, and they became known in history as the Maccabees. The Maccabees revolted successfully against Antiochus and restored the old covenant. And the word Maccabee means hammer. So these were known as the hammer people. There is another possibility for where the term Maccabee comes from. There's a common biblical expression that you find throughout the Old Testament. That is, "Who is like unto you, O God?" And you see it a lot. "Who is like unto you, O God?" And some scholars say that Maccabee is an acronym for that phrase. like we have FOT for Feast of Tabernacles. There's a Hebrew acronym that means who is like unto you, O God, that is Maccabee. But in any case, the title was given to those priests who opposed Antiochus and who finally were successful in getting rid of this evil ruler. Here's another interesting bit of history that will tie this story together for you. The Maccabee dynasty then ruled for about a century, and it was known as the Hasmonean dynasty. You may have heard of the Hasmonean dynasty. It ended after the Greeks left the scene, when the Romans then occupied Palestine. We'll hear more about this dynasty in a moment. So keep the Hasmoneans in mind. This prophecy, or this period, was prophesied in advance in the book of Daniel chapter 8, and it was remarkably accurate. It's also in Daniel chapter 11, which we'll turn to here next. This account of history in Daniel 11 and in Daniel 8 so closely parallels what took place in society and in the Middle East that people say Daniel must have written this afterwards. In fact, Daniel must not have written it at all. Somebody must have written this after all these events happened and then put his name on it. They just can't believe that it could be so accurate, so they say it's not true. If you go to the end of the chapter in chapter 8, though, especially verse 23 through 27, you'll find that there's an end-time application. And that's why I said this is a dual prophecy. What happened back then is going to happen again. You'll find there's an end-time application where a power akin to the beast is prophesied. That's in Daniel 8, verses 23 through 27. In type, the events of Daniel, including the transgression of desolation, will take place again in the end. And Daniel chapter 8 may have actually more end time significance than it even did in the 2nd century BC. Yes, we can see that Antiochus fulfilled that, but it actually may even have greater significance in the end time. So Daniel 11 now, the longest continuous prophecy in the Bible, adds to the information in Daniel 8 about what happened historically from 168 to 165 BC. And then it explains what's going to happen in the end time. Let's read about Antiochus again in Daniel 11, verse 21. Daniel 11, verse 21. And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. Here again, we read about the rise of Antiochus the Fourth, Antiochus Epiphanes. And you can prove this for yourself in a thorough study of the whole chapter alongside historical accounts. I'm not going to try and prove that right now. But eventually, when he first came to power, he wasn't thought of as a madman. He used flattery and intrigue, as you see here in verse 21. They probably thought of him as quite likable initially. But then once he took power, something got a hold of him, and he went crazy. And they said, this is Antiochus the Mad. Like Antiochus, verse 21 here is also a type of the end-time king of the north, the beast, as you'll see. You'll remember that Revelation tells us that the world will marvel at the beast. But then the whole thing goes horribly wrong, right? At first they think it's a great idea, and then it goes horribly wrong. So here in this story, the people of God were at a critical point in history. The Jews were caught between the empire in Egypt to the south, the Ptolemies, one quarter of Alexander's descendants, or four rulers, and the empire in the north in Syria, the Seleucids. And in many respects, the people of God in the end time will also be caught between opposing political and religious views that are brought on by an end-time beast. Mediterranean means the center of the earth, and it's where Asia, Europe, and Africa come together. And it's a position from which the tribes of Israel and Judah could have influenced the other nations for the best if they'd done well. But as we know, unfortunately, they sinned and became a doormat in the Middle East. And in the Middle East, even today, you have to be very powerful or you're going to become a doormat. And at this point in history, they were a doormat, and armies were marching up and down between Egypt and Syria, right through the glorious land, as Daniel said. So getting back to verse 21, we see how Antiochus ingratiates his way in. And then, once in, he changes and becomes a terror. And there's a whole lot more prophecy that's played out in real history in the next dozen verses here about Antiochus. But let's jump down to verse 29. You know, we could study more about exactly what Antiochus did, but look at verse 29. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south. But it shall not be like the former or the latter. It's going to be different this time. Verse 30. For ships from Cyprus will come against him. Therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So those who forsake the Holy Covenant, he's going to give preference to. But Antiochus here is trying to expand his empire. But Rome at this time is now rising in the West that eventually would take over the Greek Empire, right? As you know from history. And Rome had a fleet in the Mediterranean. And it stopped Antiochus's westward expansion. So now he turns south from Syria to Palestine to make sure that at least he has that securely held. And he's in a rage and he wants to do the Jews damage. That's verses 29 and 30 about those ships from Cyprus that stop him. That was Rome that was now rising as an empire. Antiochus' intent was also to show regard for those Jews who forsook the covenant of God, that were on his side. A sort of bribe and pressure for others to forsake the covenant too. But the Maccabees wouldn't do that. They stood up for the truth. Verse 31, and forces shall be mustered by him, that's Antiochus, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. You see, this is a little more information of what we read about in Daniel chapter 8. Note that there are four things that he does here in verse 31. And it's important to recognize because these four things are also going to all be there at the end time, when the duality of this prophecy is fulfilled before Christ's return. Number one, first we have military occupation of the Temple Mount and Jerusalem. Forces mustered, right? Number two, we read about a kind of rampage where things are destroyed and defiled, defiling the sanctuary. Number three, the next thing is sacrifices are prevented from taking place. And of course, we'll have to wait and see what the modern equivalent of that may be. The preventing of whatever would be the antitype of those sacrifices. And then number four, finally, he will place there the abomination of desolation. It will be some hideous act of a future ruler who will set himself up as a deity in the end time to be worshipped in place of the true God. You see, that's what Antiochus did back in Daniel 8, verse 13, and repeated here in Daniel 11, verse 31. This is during the time of 168 BC. And it will happen again just before Jesus returns. Look at verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, you know, those who give up on their Jewish faith, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. There were people at that time, in the 160s BC, that knew who God was, the way of life that was expected of them, they had a commitment to it, and they would not compromise. And it was a guerrilla war, a small band against a mighty empire. And the only way the Maccabees could have succeeded was with God's intervention. And God intervened, and he worked it out in a very physical way. For us, as converted sons and daughters in God's family, we'll have to do it in a very spiritual way. In other words, never compromise on our beliefs. You know, I have to ask myself, will I, as a child of God today, have that kind of resolve when the falsehood and abominations rise again? So let's talk about us, because verse 32 is about the Hasmoneans. But verses 33 through 35 are about those who truly understand. Verse 33, those of the people who understand, these are the people of God, shall instruct many, will teach the truth, will preach the gospel. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Then when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall. Some of God's people will fall. To refine them, purify them, make them white, until the time of the end. Because it is still for the appointed time. See, the people we're reading about here now know more than simply who God is and what he's commanded. No, they have understanding. And that understanding comes from the ministry of Jesus Christ through God's Spirit and through conversion. We know that ancient Israel wasn't converted. This is a different group of people being talked about now. And this is where the prophecy moves from the Old Testament period into the New Testament period. God's church in the New Testament had periods of time when it was under tremendous pressure and even martyrdom and persecution in the last 2,000 years. And unfortunately, from the book of Revelation, we see at some time in the future, it will again be the case. At the beginning of the message, I said that the Feast of Dedication is in many respects a rebuttal of the winter solstice and those festivals. People were celebrating the solstice holiday back then. You know, it was a different version of what became, quite honestly, Christmas today. And trying to force God's people, the Jews, to get involved with the orgies and everything else that was part of that observance. Finally, the Maccabees overthrew the soldiers of Antiochus and cleansed the temple during the time of the pagan celebrations. During that week. And then they declared a feast of dedication to God as a rebuttal. They said, if you wanted us to blend in, we're doing the opposite. The anniversary of the very day you attempted to defile the temple is now going to be our feast of rededication to the temple of God. And so on the 25th day of the ninth month of Kislev, they established an eight-day festival of dedication. And from that point to this, it has been celebrated. And ironically, although people think of it as some kind of Jewish version of Christmas, it's in effect the opposite. And incidentally, when the Jews celebrated this Feast of Dedication and established it, it was established to be the 25th day of the ninth month, which means it'll fall on different days each year, different weeks each year. It means it's kept according to the Hebrew calendar. And it always begins on the 25th day of the ninth month on the Hebrew calendar. Therefore, it rarely ever actually coincides with Christmas today, which is kept on the Roman calendar. There's a history book called First and Second Maccabees. It was completed about 100 BC. And it's the story of what the Maccabees endured and them then setting up this feast of dedication. It's available in some Bibles. Catholic Bibles have Maccabees in there. I think the Church of England may have the book of Maccabees in their version of the Bible. But we don't see it as canonical ourselves. We see it as a history book, not scripture. But it was written about 100 BC. 50 or 60 years after the events. It'd be like us writing about the Vietnam War now or the Korean War. Here's what the U.S. did in the Korean War. Here's what this general did and what that general did. Here's the march on, Hanoi or whatever, right? This is kind of what the Maccabees did. They wrote it all down. And it's an interesting book of history. I'm going to read to you Now, if you've got a Catholic Bible, you may have it in the Bible. I don't think most of us do, but 1 Maccabees chapter... it's not scripture. 1 Maccabees chapter 1, I'm going to read verses 57 to 67. But listen to this. Here's their account of what took place. On the 15th day of the month, Kislew, or Kislev, in the 145th year, to 145, according to the Jewish, it's not exactly the same as BC as we count today. In the 145th year, King Antiochus, so they even identify him as King Antiochus, set up the abominable idol of desolation upon the altar of God, and they built altars throughout all the cities of Judah round about. And they burnt incense and sacrificed at the doors of the houses and the streets. They cut in pieces and burnt with fire the books of the law of God. And every one with whom the books of the testament of the Lord were found, you know, whoever were truly, you know, trying to obey God, the true Jews, whosoever observed the law of the Lord, they put to death according to the edict of the king. You see, so if you went along with it, your life was spared. If you're on the inside, your life was spared. But if you didn't go along with Antiochus, you were killed. Thus, by their power did they deal with the people of Israel that were found in the cities month after month. And on the 25th day of the month, which is 10 days later, they sacrificed upon the altar of the idol. It was over against the altar of God. So now they had an idol altar. Now the women that circumcised their children were slain, according to the commandment of King Antiochus. They hung the children about their necks in all their houses. And those that had circumcised them, they put to death. And many of the people of Israel determined with themselves that they would not eat unclean things. And they chose rather to die than to be defiled with unclean meats. They would not break the holy law of God. They were put to death, and there was great wrath upon the people. It took about 10 days till Antiochus got his sacrifices going. First he put up a statue, and some historians like Solomon Graves will speculate that the statue looked like him. But could you imagine being a part of what I just read? If you circumcised your boy, they killed the woman who would do such a thing. And then they hung the infants from their mother's necks. It's reminiscent of Europe even in the 1940s. It's the ultimate in anti-Semitism. I was just reading 2 weeks ago, on September 12th of this year, Elizabeth Wolfe gave a presentation at a breakfast meeting hosted by Faith McDonald at the Institute on Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C., and Miss Wolf, her name is Elizabeth Sabadich Wolf, said at the meeting that in the past 10 years or so, anti-Semitism has risen to a level not seen in Europe since the fall of the Third Reich. As you probably already know, the new Jew hatred largely originates from European Muslims, the new Swedes, the new Germans, the new Austrians, and so on. That's the end of the quote. So that's the account historically. People being martyred for their convictions. And we even see it rising again today. Yet even in that martyrdom, God's people really are the victors. Because we understand the truth, and we understand the truth of the resurrection. And we're not volunteering, but if it comes to that, we have faith that we will live again. Just like Job did and others. We know that we'll be resurrected. I'm going to jump ahead to 1 Maccabees chapter 4. Read to you verses 52 through 56. And here's now where the Maccabees then rose up. This is now the Maccabees part. The first quote was about what Antiochus did to everybody that wouldn't follow along. Here's then what the Maccabees did. They arose before the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month. So at the very same day, 3 years later, that Antiochus first started destroying the temple, which is, it says, the month of Kislev, in the 148th year. It was 145th a minute ago, now it's 148th year. So it's 3 years later. And they offered sacrifice according to the law upon the new altar of Holocaust which they had made, according to the time and according to the day wherein the heathens had defiled it. So on the very same day, 3 years later, they decided to do this. and the same day was it dedicated anew, with canticles and harps and lutes and cymbals. And all the people fell upon their faces and adored and blessed up to heaven him that had prospered them. And they kept the dedication of the altar 8 days, and they offered holocaust with joy and sacrifices of salvation and of praise. Now, we don't know why they decided to sanctify the temple on the anniversary of the very day it was first defiled. But in doing so, they were fulfilling a prophecy. Remember, the number of days was already predicted. 1150 days from the beginning of the abomination to the end. One thing we do know for certain, that year was certainly not their best Feast of Tabernacles. It was not the best feast ever, or the best feast yet. They had been on the run in a guerrilla war for 3 years. So what they did at this time was a kind of a mini post-feast celebration. And it lasted 8 days. They didn't build booths and live in temporary dwellings, and you certainly don't do that in December in the Middle East. It's cold out. And it's the rainy season. So what they did was they kindled lights. And in the time of Christ, it was customary in Jerusalem at the Feast of Tabernacles to kindle lights and candles. And that was actually a very important part of the Feast of Tabernacles in Jesus' day. It's not commanded in the Bible, but it was a custom that had developed, you know, an FOT custom that they had. So great torches were lit. So this was one custom from the Feast of Tabernacles that the Jews thought was good to keep with this Feast of Dedication. Too cold out to have temporary dwellings, but they decided to do the candle thing. And so it was became known as the Jewish Festival of Lights, the Feast of Dedication. And also the 8-day celebration was modeled after the dedication of the temple at the time of Hezekiah. In 2 Chronicles 29, verse 17, we read that back then they rededicated the temple for 8 days. So the Maccabees would have known that and probably said, we're going to do it for 8 days too. So there's a lot of parallels here. So I'm going to read to you now from 1 Maccabees 4, verse 59. It says, and Judas, who was now known as Judas Maccabee, Judas and his brothers and all the church of Israel decreed that the day of the dedication of the altar should be kept in its season from year to year for 8 days, from the 25th day of the month of Kislev, with joy and gladness. So Judah the Maccabee, Judah the Hammer, was a military commander who is now a legendary figure in the Jewish community because of his military prowess. And he was a very devout man. He and the rabbis that were with him and their families would not go along with the paganism. And it was a rebuttal against the paganism of the day, in particular the observance and celebration of the sun god during the winter. And as you will see now in the coming weeks, it's a festival that remains to this day. They still do it. They still keep Hanukkah. In the time of Christ, the Jews observed the festival. And as did Jesus Christ himself, was there at the temple during the Feast of Dedication. It's not commanded on the church, but it was a day that Christ thought appropriate to observe, like we keep Thanksgiving in November in America. And most of us church members do the same. A major lesson we can learn from the Feast of Dedication is that God's people will have the victory if they do not compromise. And sometimes it's the ultimate victory. It'll come later in your life. We are not to be overcome by the world during this upcoming season, but we are to overcome the world. We don't get involved in the worldly celebrations that are ungodly and unbiblical. We have to remain a community of commandment keepers and not compromise. And this now leads us to the end time fulfillment of this whole subject. Matthew 24, verses 15 through 18. And here are Jesus' words on this subject. Matthew 24, verse 15. What does Jesus say in this prophecy? Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, when you see that abomination standing in the holy place, he says, you better know what you're believing. You better understand now. Let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are on the housetops not go down to take anything out of the house. Let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. Christ said, this is going to be a nasty time. You'll have to flee for your life if you're one that's not compromising. Now, on this subject, we don't have all the answers. But after reading Daniel, which Christ referenced here, and the other historical documents, we have more background to understand and study here. Christ says, when you see this event, you have to flee for your life. That's what happened back then. When Antiochus performed that abomination, the next step was for God's people to get out of the city, or they'd be murdered. If you didn't go along with it, you were killed. You had your kids hung around your neck. And there's coming a time again when the church will literally have to get out of the situation because it's going to be that dangerous. If you compromise, this end time ruler will let you live. But if you don't compromise, your life's on the line. Christ says, that's the time to get out of the city. That's the time to flee. Verse 20, and pray, notice this, that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. See, those who are listening to Christ would have been very aware of the history of that time. They knew exactly what he was referring to. Because in Christ's time, it would have been like us remembering the Civil War. We know quite a bit about the Civil War and what happened, and the battles that were fought in Gettysburg and other places. So in Christ's time, they knew what the Maccabees did. They knew when the abomination of desolation was set up. They knew the history. And they knew it happened in the wintertime. And Christ was saying, when this happens again, pray it's not in the wintertime. Not a good time to be fleeing when there's snow on the ground. The Maccabees defended God's truth against the pagans. And Jesus said, this scenario is going to repeat itself. He said it could come at a very inopportune time, like on the Sabbath. And he said they had to flee in the winter back then. You need to pray that it doesn't happen in the wintertime. We also read a parallel account in Mark chapter 13. It's very similar. But let's turn to Luke's version, because Luke adds another detail here. Because remember the 4 points of what Antiochus did in 168 BC? The first one was military occupation. And that's the main point here of Luke 21. Luke 21, verse 20. Here's Jesus talking about this abomination of desolation again. He says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea, if you're in the city, flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Let not those who are in the country enter her. So if you're out in the suburbs, if you're out in the rural areas, don't come into town. Of course, the prophecy of Jerusalem there. But it'll be the same for God's people. Don't get involved. Don't go into town to see what's going on. Don't compromise. Flee these abominations. Spiritually. So those in the rural areas are to stay away. Those who are in the city, get out. And it's preceded by a military occupation of the city, which was the first step of what Antiochus did in the prophecy about him in Daniel 11. And lest you think, like some people do, that this is only talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, read the remainder of the chapter sometime, where it says, this abomination will precede the heavenly signs of the sixth seal and the return of Jesus Christ. It's an end-time warning that Christ is giving here. Now let's go to 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. Because here's a prophecy in Thessalonians that makes a whole lot more sense if you have all of the historical background. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. And as we get closer to these events, God will give his church more understanding, and we'll start to see what it all means in greater detail. We don't have to fret over it, but it does give us a good perspective of what is to come at the end of mankind's rule of this world. 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 3. Let no one deceive you by any means, for that day will not come, talking about the end time, unless the falling away comes first, and the man of sin is revealed, the son of perdition. And who is this man of sin? Verse 4. Who opposes and exalts himself above all that is called God, above all that is worshipped, so that he sits as God. He's the Antiochus Epiphanes, so to speak. He sits as God in the temple of God, showing himself that he is God. Verse 5, do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? Verse 7, for the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who now restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. See, it's an end time prophecy about the time just before Christ returns. Christ will have to consume this person that sets himself up as God. Verse 9, the coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders. See, that's where the real battle is. It's a spiritual battle. Verse 10, with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth that they might be saved. Right, there's a warning for those who compromise. Verse 10 says, don't compromise if you want to be saved. Paul is saying an apostasy must precede Christ's coming. And this event would seem to be tied in with duality with the prophecies of Antiochus, in type. Antiochus opposed God and wanted to be worshipped, saying he was a god. And the Thessalonians reading this account would have probably remembered the history of Antiochus in Daniel 11 in terms of the pattern and its type. But it's going to occur again. The Romans didn't do this fully in 70 AD. Yes, Jerusalem was destroyed, but there was not a full-scale fulfillment like Daniel 11 in 70 AD. Not such as will yet occur. This is an end-time prophecy here in Thessalonians. In verse 5, the Apostle Paul says, do you not remember that when I was still with you, I told you these things? See, Paul struggled even then to keep false teachings and false practices out of the church. Every town and city he visited, he said, when I leave, apostasy is going to creep in. And it did. And it's continued right down through history to our time. False teachings in the church. Paul said, it's already at work. Watch out. And I'm talking about Christianity in general, not God's church. It happened in type back then in Paul's day. False religious leaders rose up, and certain individuals became very powerful in the first few centuries of early Christianity, to the extent that within about 300 years, a very large counterfeit Christianity rose to prominence and is the largest Christian church to this day. But it's a counterfeit of the truth. Let's turn to Revelation chapter 3. Revelation chapter 3. And as we read a couple of verses in Revelation 3, keep in mind that those who read Revelation are expected to have already read the rest of the Bible. And therefore, if you read Revelation, you're expected to have some familiarity with the writings of Daniel, Zechariah, the Psalms, and the more recent words of Jesus Christ himself on this subject. Now, many scholars believe that the Maccabees were the Philadelphians of the Old Testament, the zealous group in the congregation of Israel. They were the ones who had a little strength, but who had a zeal for God's law, and God protected them and gave them the victory. People see a parallel between the Philadelphian church in Revelation and what the Maccabees did. At the time of the Maccabees, there were people to the north who had a counterfeit religion. combination of paganism and the Old Covenant. They were the Samaritans. Remember Christ's dealings with the Samaritan woman at the well and other Samaritans? They were a mixed group of Israelites, Jews, and Gentiles. And there were times, as the historian Josephus says, when they claimed to be Jews when it was to their advantage, but they were actually a mixed race. In Revelation 3:12, now in a New Testament context, talking to the church at Philadelphia, which, like I said, many scholars believe is antitypical of the Maccabees, we again find people who claim to be Jews but are not. People who claim to be spiritual Jews or Christians but are not. They may even think they are, but they aren't. And let's add one more thought here. The Maccabees were a physical people, a physical congregation of God in the Old Testament times. They were not a converted group of people, but they stood up for the truth as they knew it. And they were a nation then who waged war, who involved themselves in diplomacy at that time in history. In fact, the Maccabees made a deal with the Roman Empire. And that's one reason why they were so successful against the Greeks. The interesting thought is that the Maccabees, there in the Middle East, did the same as the unconverted Israelis of today do. They have to wage war for their very survival, in an unconverted sense. Well, the Maccabees had a problem with the Samaritans to the north in the 1st and 2nd century BC. These were Samaritans who claimed to be faithfully worshipping God, but they were faking it. And they set up their own version of the temple, and they did things very differently. And they ordained their own priests. Finally, in 128 BC, the Hasmonean dynasty, the descendants of Judah Maccabee, conquered the Samaritans and destroyed their temple to the north. And it was a type, in a sense, of what God's people will ultimately do in the end time. With Jesus Christ, we will eventually do away with false religions and establish God's true religion on this earth. We will be part of destroying all the false temples, the false religions. And that's actually the message of the millennium, the Feast of Tabernacles that we just observed. So the Maccabees did that in their own small way, destroying the false worship center to the north that the Samaritans had. That's what Revelation 3 is dealing with. And the Apostle John no doubt knew how history and prophecy were so intertwined in this way. Revelation 3:9. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I'll make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Saying, I'm going to show those people where the real truth is. And John was no doubt aware of the backstory of what the Hasmoneans did to the Samaritans, those who said they were Jews and were not. And Revelation now shows a prophecy of the same type of thing happening again when Christ returns. Those who are the true followers, Jesus Christ tells through the Apostle John here in this vision, the false Christians of the world will someday know that I loved you, the true people of God, and they will come and worship at your feet. In other words, the rest of the world will become converted. The rest of the world will come to know the truth. And their religious systems will be torn down. Notice verse 12 here of Revelation 3. He who overcomes, you're talking to the church, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. And I'll write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. See, those who overcome, no more will we have to go out. No more will we have to flee like those people did in those days. God's people had to go into survival mode back then. That will be no more. Jesus Christ will be ruling, and the people of God will be permanent pillars in the temple. They won't have to flee and get out of there. Here's a final scripture to conclude in Revelation 5, verse 10. Revelation 5 and verse 10. There's actually another parallel to this whole story. The Hasmoneans, you know, those that came from the Maccabees, were a family of priests who took over political rulership as kings because it was necessary at the time. It wasn't the best setup for the priests to also be the kings and the princes, but they didn't have much choice. There was not much else they could do after surviving the guerrilla war. They were waiting for the anointed king of God who would come, the Messiah. And he would then become their king and their priest. But until that time, they took upon themselves to be both kings and priests. Unfortunately, when Jesus Christ did come, they didn't recognize him. They didn't accept him. You know how that story goes as far as the Jews are concerned. We read in prophecy that they will here in the future. But the Hasmoneans did the best they could as kings and priests in Palestine. But the Hasmonean dynasty finally crumbled. The nation descended into civil war. So then the Romans intervened and took advantage of that by conquering the area. And when Jesus came to the earth, the Jews were now a subjugated people under the thumb of the Roman Empire. So the Hasmoneans actually finally disappeared. But they attempted this king and priest type rulership. But God's church is not going to crumble. God's church is not going to disappear like the Hasmoneans did. God's church is going to endure. And look what becomes of it in Revelation 5 verse 10. And have made us kings and priests to our God, and we shall reign on the earth. As Psalms 149 verse 9 says, this honor have all the saints. Psalm 149 is about the kingdom of God and the role the saints have to play in it. And Psalm 149 verse 9 says, this honor have all the saints, praise the Lord. And I pray that this study of the Maccabees and the abomination of desolation, along with its prophetic significance, will encourage you to remain faithful in the days ahead. Especially if you happen to live through the end time fulfillment of these events, don't compromise. Be a spiritual Maccabee. Stand up for the truth no matter what. Because if so, you will then have the honor given to the saints of being spiritual kings and priests to our God and reigning with Christ on this earth.